Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen, and Michael Bridges join me as we wrap up the biggest stories from the weekend, including managerial sackings left, right, and center. Were they too harsh, or who is next? Before we look forward to a jam-packed weekend of international football and, of course, our Socceroos back on home soil. What we love, what we don't love, all that and plenty more coming up on the Gegenpod. What's happening, guys? Welcome to another edition of the Gegenpod. I've got my all-star cast back once again. Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen, and Michael Bridges. We're going to dive straight into it as we wrap up all the club football and move towards an international weekend. Tommy, I'm going to start with you. The manager axe continues to swing. We saw it at your former club, Aston Villa. Dean Smith has been relieved of his duties, and the latest rumour to come out in the last 24 hours that Kasper Hjulmand may be the man to replace him, the Danish international coach. What have you made of it all?
Again, I think it's been a bit surprising. We talked about it last week, and I actually said that Smith and Farke was on the line. I didn't expect him to go this week, I must say. And I feel a little bit sorry for Dean Smith, because he's actually done a great job. When the club was in turmoil, he came in, leveled the ship. They were in the League Cup final last year, and he's been hit a bit with injuries, had to play some. Like, we're just looking at the bench this week. He had Ramsey, Archer, Keenan Davis. These are 20-year-olds, and you can't expect them to come in and change games. And they paid a price, really, for some bad set plays. And then I think the Wolves game was a huge turning point, because they had that in a bag, lost it, and then they lost momentum. And still haven't been able to bed Leon Bailey and Buendia into the team to replace Grealish, really, who was the talisman. So I feel for him, but Hjulmand, I hope he doesn't leave Denmark, because he's doing a fantastic job there. But he's a good manager, a little bit like Frank at Brentford. He's got that same ethos, build the team spirit, he's great into character. His tactical knowledge is extremely good. He's been around. His philosophy is spot on. I think Villa will be happy if they get him, but I hope not, because I want him to stay with Denmark and take us to the World Cup.
Almost. Do you reckon he would leave Denmark? Just leading up to a World Cup not far away. Obviously, Denmark did brilliantly well at the Euros. Do you reckon he would leave and go? Not far away from the World Cup.
I don't think he'll leave now. The opportunity can be too good, the money can be too good, but I think the vibe I get from the team, from him, obviously, as you said, the Euros, the fantastic performance. I think he wants to at least do the World Cup, and hopefully after that, then I think these opportunities will be enticing to him, but I don't think he'll go now. And sadly, I think Villa will have to look elsewhere.
So according to last week, where Thomas said that Dean Smith and Farke wouldn't go, so then he's definitely going to go to Villa, isn't he?
No, I said they were on the hot seat.
Yeah, but you didn't think they were going to go this week, though, didn't you? You said were surprised they went this week.
Yeah. Sorry, I got it wrong.
You got the timing wrong, mate. You got to do better next time. According to Mark Schwarzer, I think Claudio Ranieri only has about 6 weeks left. Bridgie, we spoke at length about the Norwich sacking as well. They finally get their first win of the season, and Daniel Farke is let go. I mean, is this that one seemed like it was coming for quite some time, but we now have 5 sackings in the first 11 rounds. Are we just pulling the trigger too soon? What's going on?
Oh, it's been absolutely frightening. I mean, the rumors going around about Farke is that some of the journals actually knew at half time or halfway through the second half. There was a lot of speculation that he was on his way. Now, if you look at his interview after the game, and the way I saw Tim Krul celebrating with him and the way his players, he had no idea. And I really thought that was harsh. This has happened in the past, by the way. There's been, I think Martin Yol was the best at Tottenham Hotspur. The story that I've heard on that one, and a lot of people would have done that. He got sacked and he didn't even have a clue. He was reading it in the newspaper the following morning. So this kind of thing does happen. It's very harsh. I didn't think it would happen to Farker, to be honest with you, after Thomas talked about it, because I thought he was on a really good thing there. They were happy, whether they went up or down. He seems to be the man that can bounce them back. How long that trend can continue. Dean Smith caught me out. I've got to say that was, I thought he had credit in the tank. I think they've pulled the trigger far too early. I still think he's got unfinished business. It was a test in time for him, no doubt about it, but that's how you become better managers, and the players around you go on that journey with you. So I felt that he had a little bit more time. Newcastle United was inevitable. Since the new consortium took over Steve Bruce, that was always going to happen if it had been Mike Ashley. I think Bruce had a job there until the end of his reign. And then the other one was Spurs. Nuno Espirito Santo, that's Swarty. I backed him all the way. But obviously, after the first three games, it was looking so promising. And then, obviously, it just everything fell to pieces. And I think what Daniel Levy has done, which probably the only time I'm going to say I'm delighted with some of the business he's done, he realised that Man United were sniffing with Conte. And there's not, you know, it was a good opportunity to get somebody in to, like I say, kick some backsides, change the, I think, sort them players out and try to have a go, because it did look like the players had actually lost the motivation under Nuno. So it's been an incredible week. Some of them I agree with, some of them I don't.
Yeah, it's interesting because you just feel like when you see the players, I mean, Arsenal, there were rumours after three games that they would potentially get rid of Mikel Arteta. I mean, they've stuck with him. He went on to win Manager of the Month. He's doing brilliantly. As a player, Schwartzy, thinking back to your career, do you ever remember any time when managerial sackings, do the players have too much power? Did you know before the manager knew, or any memories of managerial sackings from your career?
It was early on in my career where it was like honestly, it was a manager roundabout going on. Like, it was just changeover of managers left, right, and center. So in Germany, first club in Dresden, I think we had three managers in the same season. And one left, actually. He left, had a chance to go to Japan, left. And then new manager came in. Horst Rubisch, who played for Germany, scored some big goals for them, Euros back in the day. And he, lovely guy, really top guy. And he was kind of almost dead man walking, because you don't start picking up results. The president was ruthless, and he showed it. He was ruthless and got rid of him after, I think, like 2 months. Mm. And you kind of know the writing's on the wall. Same as happened when I went to Kaiserslautern. We had a manager go, I think it was just after Christmas, actually. I think it was around January, February time he got the sack as well. And it just seemed, you kind of knew it was going to happen. You just wondered when it was going to happen, unless something dramatically changed. But when you're in that group, I don't know what you guys think, but you generally get a feel of whether or not, and people talk, so you know whether players are with the manager or not with the manager, and you know whether he's lost the change room or hasn't. And sometimes there's a divide. Actually, a lot of times there's a divide. There's the divide of the guys who are playing, and then the divide is the guys that are not playing. They're obviously annoyed they're not playing. And it just depends where the power lies. And then do some of the guys that are playing get swung, and then all of a sudden the change room becomes not a very healthy environment. But that generally, not in the clubs that I've been in at anyway, that very rarely, I think, has had a say in whether the manager stayed or went.
Swartzy, were you at Chelsea with Villas Boas or not?
No. Mourinho, I came after, I was like Mourinho's first signing when he really signed. Apparently, I was like, I was his number one target, apparently.
So. You better check what you're drinking in that cup of tea or coffee, yours, mate, because I can smell a bit of BS there.
Yeah, exactly.
That's brilliant. It got us thinking here at Optus Sport, Tommy, about the harshest manager sackings of all time. And there have been a few just in the last 10 years that spring to mind. But what, in your opinion, is the harshest manager sacking in the Prem?
You know, now talking about Chelsea, I think we can look at a few of theirs. Who Di Matteo, who won the championship, took over, won the Champions League, did reasonably well, and then got sacked. I think probably the weirdest was probably from last season. I think Frank de Boer at Crystal Palace, like, he was there for 70 something days, only I think 30 days. In charge, actually on the field, and got sacked after four games. You know, that was a weird, harsh, you know, it just seems, well, why would you go through the due diligence with a manager and then sack him after four games? Doesn't make any sense. But I think Chelsea, Watford. Those clubs, I think, can have 4 or 5 managers in that top 10. but Chelsea, I think, definitely top. They've had some shockers as well. Di Matteo is probably Ancelotti as well, who did well for them and got sacked. Abramovich got a happy tricker.
I think with Di Matteo, I think also it was what's going on behind the scenes. So players, I think they very much realised that he had the effect. A lot of the players actually did a lot of the work and took them over the line, and they won the Champions League. Of course, he's got a. And then there's a bit like what I said about Ranieri, about at Leicester. He managed the situation at the time really, really well. And the second season when he started took more on and actually made more decisions, then it all went pear-shaped because he was great at just managing the overall situation and letting it all unfold. But then when he actually had to make his own decision, it wasn't great. But what I heard about Crystal Palace was that when De Boer came in, he tried to change too much too quickly. And also, he wanted to turn them into basically the Ajax of England, and I don't think Palace were at the time ready for it and obviously didn't have the players to do it. And I think the club then panicked after losing a couple of games. And I think from my understanding as well, the relationship turned sour pretty quickly.
This is that Dutch philosophy, Sporty. Yeah. The one that we brought into the FFA curriculum. Yeah.
Yeah,
at Crystal Palace neither.
Yeah, but I think when you look at the Dutch, I mean, going obviously a bit of a sideward step here, but if you talk about the Dutch philosophy in terms of overhauling an overall system where you're wanting to develop kids from a young age all the way up, I mean, that's different to taking over a team and whether there's promotion and relegation involved and trying to change things over a couple of months rather than, we're talking when you're implementing a whole criteria.
It's a completely different timescale.
Yes, exactly. It's a 10-year project. It's not an overnight thing. So yeah. I think the two can't be really, I know what you're saying, but I don't think they can be directly compared.
Okay. And Schwartz, you mentioned there about Ranieri. He was good at doing the best with the situation that was there, but as soon as he had to start making his own decisions, that was his failure. Is that what you're seeing with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer now at United?
I'm actually surprised he's lasted as long as he has. I was surprised that obviously he went on that incredible run when he first took over, and then there was a period afterwards where things didn't go so well for him. And I was surprised he actually lasted that period of time. And then, we're 3 years down the line and he's still in charge. I think United are just in that thing and that position whereby they've tried the sure thing, the supposed sure thing, as we all know, in Van Gaal, Mourinho, and then obviously the next one was Conte. And I just don't think, I just think that they were just so afraid of the whole Conte image and persona and personality. And you see it, whether it was at Chelsea, Inter Milan, Juve, and I just don't think United wanted that. That's why they mustn't have, because that's why they chose not to take him on. Because if they thought, there's no doubt in my mind, I reckon if they thought he was the right man, they would have taken him. They would have made the change. But I just don't think they think at the moment the right person is available. I wouldn't be surprised if United are waiting for Pochettino.
Oh, wow. I mean, he's flying high. He's top of the league in France by quite a bit. But it just feels like it's not quite working. Yeah, but it just feels like
surprises you there.
It just feels strange, doesn't it, Schwartz? It doesn't feel like it's the right match.
No. As in who Pochettino, you mean?
Pochettino with PSG.
Oh, no, I agree with you. And there are rumbles coming out of Paris about in the media. They've been talking about the fact that the change room don't speak in French. And apparently it's kind of an unwritten rule at the club that all the new players, and which is understandable. You're in France and you want people to speak in the language, right? And apparently the dressing room basically speaks either English or Spanish. So the French speaking ones are not particularly happy about it. And the club, I think, as an identity are not particularly happy with that. And add to the mix that Messi seemingly is not overall enthused by it all, the situation and not really going that well. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised if it comes to a head. I really wouldn't.
I mean, he's got a clause in his contract where he can go home whenever he wants. So even though he's been injured the last few weeks, him and Paredes jumped on a plane and they're back in Argentina. So a bit of a shambles in the way it's run over there. Bridgie, I'm going to bring it back to the Prem with you. We're talking managers. Eddie Howe was finally announced by Newcastle. Is there a sense of, I mean, you had to be realistic with who you could get in. I know names were tossed around like Unai Emery and Antonio Conte at one stage, but you're the only, Newcastle's the only winless team in the Prem. Eddie Howe seems like a pretty good outcome, right?
He does when you consider the managers that we've been talked about. And I, you know, money talks, don't get us wrong. But managers like Unai Emery and Conte, they've got CVs and they want to keep the track record good. They don't want to have a relegation on their CV. And it's a huge gamble. Just because there's been a takeover and there's going to be talk of signs in January, it doesn't guarantee you that you're going to stay in the Premier League. So, you know, there's a little bit of that going on in the background when you're looking at the takeover thinking, you know, this is a tough battle to come into. And I don't think that's the situation they're going to have with players. Are they really going to be able to sign, or is it going to be loan deals and looking for players that aren't going to commit to a long-term contract? Because obviously the uncertainty, once they get to next season, they're safe in the Premier League. In the off-season, they'll have a right good go. And at this moment in time, Eddie Howe, he's got a fantastic track record with players that he's developed and brought through through the leagues as well in England. He's now teamed up again with Callum Wilson, Ryan Fraser and Richie. Whether him and Fraser are going to get on, I don't know, because there's an interesting thing happened at Bournemouth, if you remember, when lockdown came in. Fraser decided not to sign a contract and refused to play for Bournemouth, which ended up they got relegated. So whether Eddie Howe holds a grudge against Fraser remains to be seen. But I'm actually really, really happy with the appointment, I've got to say that. And I like what Amanda Stevely said about the, you know, he's seen the vision, he's seen what we want to do over the next couple of years, and he's taken a real interest in the academy. He's asked the questions. However, it nearly fell through because I think he wants to bring some of his staff. How many he's allowed to bring, I don't know, because they've still got Steve Agnew, Steve Clement on the book, and obviously Jones is really well thought of at the football club at all levels. So I'm happy with the appointment, I've got to say, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he's going to do.
I just find it really weird that, or bizarre. What is the vision of the club? You know, surely they need to bring in a director of football to have that vision in place. I think that's been part of their issue. And that's why, you know, when you saw, you know, Emery, the Dutch manager, all said the same thing, had reservations about the club, or what certainly was reported that way, about the direction of the club. They're talking about Michael Emanuele, who was at Chelsea recently, at Monaco, as a director of football, you know, which is interesting. I mean, I know him personally, and he's a really good guy, and he obviously had a really good time at Chelsea, and didn't quite work out for him at Monaco. But I think that's something they needed to put in place before, and have a vision.
Do you not think they're waiting, Swarty? I think that's probably the most important position that they're going to have to fill in the next few months. Going into January.
Surely that's all linked, isn't it? That's all linked to the manager, right? I mean, surely...
I think it has to. Otherwise, you know, again, you're talking about a plan. Everyone needs to be on the same page from the start. You can't have people pulling in different directions, exactly. Wanting different players. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And why would you bring a director of football in that doesn't necessarily have a relationship? I mean, it says that, you know, Michael Emanuele is a fan of Eddie Howe. I mean, that's what's reported. I mean, is he really? I don't know. It obviously is a good narrative to go with right now if he does get appointed. Yeah, so it's an interesting one. I just think they've met out their plan soon enough. I think that's probably the problem. That's probably why they weren't able to get probably the number one or number two or number three or number five candidate.
It kind of sounds like they did in reverse order, right? It would make sense. Yes. You get the director of football first.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
I heard they were after Arsene Wenger just before they were about to take over. There was talk that Wenger was going to come in to sort everything out from FIFA to help them behind the scenes. And the other thing that's probably going to happen, I wouldn't say, they'll try and emulate the City group. Because of Brexit and the players not able to come in under the age of 18 these days into the Premier League, there's big things. I think that's helping the City group enormously. I know you can have sister clubs and feeder clubs, but like I've said in the past, I think it's a huge opportunity for an A-League club, especially the Newcastle Jets, to try and get in that front door to Newcastle United. So, you know, could we be one of the feeder clubs for you guys?
Mm. would be interesting. It'd be good times for us. I mean, Tommy, you played for one of those feeder clubs, Melbourne City, but I want to ask you about Manchester City at the moment, because before we look forward to the week coming up, let's look back quickly at the weekend. Manchester Derby, everyone was excited for it. We kind of all had a bit of a feeling how it was going to go, but City, Pep Guardiola didn't even have to make a change for the entire game. Every single player on the park had more touches than the United players. There was a stage in the game where United had more shots at their own goal than they did at the opposition's goal. Tommy, was this as expected, or did it blow out even more than we originally thought?
I think it was exactly what we expected. I just hope that United, because it's a local derby, we know that form sort of goes out the window. I was hoping that they could mount a challenge. But, you know, we after 15, 20 minutes, you could see that that was not going to happen the way they set up, how far back they were. And just the way City, you know, just took total control. It was like watching a killer whale playing with a seal, you know, just, you know, yeah, you know, that's how it felt. You know, it's just like, wow, a group of killer whales just throwing the seal around. I think that, you know.
Wow, I've never seen that before. Wow.
No, okay, but, it's a great documentary. It's actually some good stuff. National Geographic, there you go.
And, you know, I think United, they were in for hiding. The way they set up, obviously trying to shut down the center of the pitch, you know, trying to limit the space in front of goal with obviously the three center halves, let Man City play it out wide. But you got to be able to defend crosses then, you know, and at the moment, just there's so much lacking. And Man City, fair play to them. If De Gea hadn't pulled off a few good saves in the first half, they would have been 4-5 up and well-deserved. You couldn't argue. It would have been another Liverpool game. So
that was incredible, because I think me and Claude were chatting during the week. Claude, remember we looked at the X results between the two clubs, and it was, you know, in United's favour.
Yeah.
And I said to you, I've got a feeling they're going to get smashed, and I've got a feeling it could replicate the Liverpool result. De Gea stopped it from being the Liverpool result. Liverpool were far more clinical, but I think City were far more dominant than what Liverpool were in this game. And I agree with Tommy, like, De Gea kept this from being embarrassing.
Well, he's one for you, Bridgie, because he did keep it from being embarrassing. Everyone's been saying before the season and even during that City are one striker away from being probably the best team in the Prem, if not the world. Do they even need that striker? Are they playing better now without an out-and-out forward? Or you think they still need a Harry Kane or an Erling Haaland or one of those?
I think they would take an Erling Haaland or Harry Kane, definitely, because it gives you another outlet, a plan B as well. And what I've got to credit Guardiola, and like you say, he's on a different stratosphere. When you don't have a number nine, and how he's able to adapt and get the players to buy in and start playing the way he wants them to play, or the way his staff want them to play, and they take it on board. And it's like the conductor, he has another one, like the seals playing with the whatever it was, killer whales. You know, the conductor of an orchestra, when they just, you know, everybody is singing off the same hymn sheet, and that's what Guardiola and his staff seem to be able to do with the players, and that is not an easy task.
A conductor of an orchestra is actually, they're all musicians, they're not singing, are they? Because they're an orchestra.
Well, whatever they're doing, Schwartzy, you.
I'm just trying to sound clever, Schwartzy. Let him sound clever.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, whatever they do. Saying. You know the guy with the arms that does all this, and he ting to ting to ting, dang, 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 and all that. And
what does he do?
Ting to ting, ting, ding, dang. And he tells everybody what time to come in and when to play their bit of music. It's like Pep Guardiola on the sideline. You know what I'm trying to say. And it's not an easy job, and he does it. And that's why he's an absolute genius of the game, because to have a plan up here in your head and have it on your laptop and the computers or whatever they do with it, and then to go out and put that into reality with the players to understand it, is brilliant.
I agree, right? So there's no doubting how good he is, right? Absolutely no doubting. But when you spend over £1 billion, you'd expect to have a very good team, right?
Yeah, I've no doubt about it.
Some of the best players in the world.
It still doesn't mean that they're all going to do their own thing, because Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Man United has got just as much money and has just as much talent on the field. And yet when they were playing Man City, two wide players.
I'm not going to agree with that.
The tactical mindset of Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in that game, when he had a back five in a line, and the players were absolutely petrified, the centre-halves in Bailly and Maguire, to actually leave that line because of what happened when they got smashed against Liverpool. They look so uncertain of their jobs. And that comes down to the manager and the staff at that football club, because they've given them no direction and they look absolutely shit scared.
I agree with you in that regard, but I don't agree with you by what you said in terms of they both have similar quality on the pitch. They don't. because Man City are streaks and miles ahead of the quality, man for man across the whole squad, than Man United. Because Man United have got some brilliant players, no doubt about it, but they're certainly not the same level as Man City. Or Chelsea, for that matter.
Well, here's one for you then. What's happened to Sancho? Because we were raving about him, Swartz. You saw him regularly. What has happened to him?
The manager's obviously got no belief in him. And I don't get it. Donny van der Beek, take two. I don't get it. I honestly do not understand it.
So surely that would be worrying signs for the board and the owners going, hang on a minute, yeah, we just spent a lot of money on players.
Maybe there's something we don't know. Maybe something's gone on behind the scenes. That's the only thing I can put it down to, because I'm shocked by the way it is with Donny van der Beek and with Jadon Sancho. I can't work it out.
Yeah, but also the system, you know, does it suit a Sancho? I think, you know, that's the problem. I think, you know, this game reminded me of when I was at Stoke City and Tony Pulis set us up to go to play Manchester City away. And we worked all week with a back five. And limit the space in the and it was just an onslaught. And I'm thinking, this is Man United. Like you said, Swartz, the amount of money they've spent, the quality of players, you know, that they're supposed to have, and then this is the way you set up. I just don't get it. At home in a local derby, I think it's embarrassing, and it turned out that way as well.
Tommy, you agreed with the lack of players.
I'm surprised they didn't lose by more. Sorry.
Yeah, oh, yeah,
no. They should have. Yeah,
you guys both agree that they don't have the level of talent that City have. But so we were talking about this with Bridger the other day. Would any of these United players, let's say besides Cristiano Ronaldo, maybe, would any of these United players start in that City team?
I think you'll find, you know, you could find room, but they wouldn't go straight in. It would be a like for like swap. I can't really put someone in.
No.
Yeah. Not on present form, but put Fernandes or somebody in that or a
Pogba. Yeah, I think so.
I think
Fernandes has been terrible this season. The only player that would go into the City side right now is potentially, just because of his goal scoring record, is Cristiano Ronaldo as a number nine. And obviously they wanted to sign him, didn't they?
Well, that was the only one I picked out of Claude the other day. But thinking about what Pep could do with a Fernandes or somebody, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. I don't even know whether...
It's a good debate, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah. Why wouldn't he have gone for him in the first place? You know, there's a reason why he didn't go from, you know, why they weren't interested in him. Maybe because they've got adequate players in those positions. Who knows? But, you know, listen, Pep Guardiola's got an incredible squad at his disposal. What he does incredibly well is manage them and keeps them on side. I mean, the only one that's the anomaly right now in Man City is Raheem Sterling. So there's something obviously gone amiss there. However, no doubting it, you know, to be successful as he's been, to have that group of players together, Jürgen Klopp, Pep Guardiola, Thomas Tuchel, you know, these guys manage these big squads and these players and keep them on board. That's an art in itself.
Mm. Well, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer underperforming. Bridgie, one man who is performing, David Moyes with West Ham. You predicted Liverpool. I predicted West Ham in this one. I was honestly just taking a punt in the dark, though. I don't think I even expected it to happen. They came out 3-2 winners against Liverpool. Bit of a reality check for Jurgen Klopp. How did you find this one? Was this Liverpool not up to their best, or West Ham showed that they're real top four contenders?
There was one thing we both agreed on, and that was there would be goals and it would be entertaining. And it was. It was just a special game. And, you know, the fact that West Ham got the result, I was actually delighted for them because I've really enjoyed watching them this season, the things that they are doing in the Moyes and to get one over on Liverpool, the way that they have been playing this season, that is huge. And I don't think Liverpool dropped their game. I think that West Ham took it to them and they were fearless. They weren't scared like Man United were against City that we've talked about. And they got the decisions. The decisions went in their favour in this game. And sometimes you need a little bit of that. You've got two goalkeepers here as well. I've heard Jurgen Klopp going ballistic about that first goal. For me, I don't see an issue with it. I've seen worse decisions given. I didn't see too much of anything, so it'll be interesting to see what the boys say about that. But overall, I've got to say, West Ham, I credit them. And now they are definitely serious contenders this season for that top four.
Tommy, have Liverpool got to be a bit worried about their defensive play off set pieces? Was that just a one-off? I mean, you saw from a goalkeeper's point of view, there was question marks whether it was a foul on Alisson, but is there anything to worry about from Liverpool there?
I think Yeah, you know, you got a question, Alisson. I think Bridget's spot on. You know, even though I'm a long-term member of the goalkeeping club, and I would protect the goalkeepers any day. I think, again, West Ham, they do a brilliant job. And it's probably one of the toughest teams to defend against for set plays. They remind me of, and Swarty will remember, the good old Bolton days with Kevin Davis, Kevin Nolan, and the job Antonio does on the goalkeeper is brilliant. He stands there, he anticipates, he nudges the goalkeeper just enough for you know, for your timing to be off, and then he seeks, you know, he sort of drifts off and tries to sort of pick up a second ball or a deflection. But he does exactly enough on every single corner. You even see it on I think it's the third goal, the header. Mm. You know, he just impedes Alisson enough without, you know, it's hard. You know, some players, and actually I would say 90% of players can't do that job to that level, and he does it brilliantly. And yeah, as I said, from my experience, I used to hate playing against Kevin Nolan, you know, a big guy that you can't move, who anticipates the ball flight, who just steps in your path at the right time. These players deserve a lot of credit, and he's a big part in impeding the keeper and the goals they scored at the weekend. So it's tough to be hard on Liverpool, because I think they're generally okay on set plays, but yeah. Alisson needs to be stronger in that situation for sure.
I don't think it was a foul either. He certainly was nudged around. He was certainly brushed. His arm was brushed by Antonio initially, and then also by who was it that sort of gets in front of him?
Agbona.
And so there is a slightest of touch. And I actually think, like Thomas was saying there, like, you know, Alisson needs to do better, and he'll know that. I think he was so distracted by those guys. He actually, they distracted him from him doing his job. And then when it came to it, I think he was caught out of it. Obviously he was caught out. You know, to me, he wasn't focused enough on dealing with the danger in the cross. And obviously then his confidence had gone slightly. And then the second half, the same thing with the third goal, you can see he commits. You know, I think he almost takes like a step forward. Certainly his body movement was going forward. And then all of a sudden he realizes it's over the back of him and he just couldn't get back and make the save. And so couldn't get to the cross, which he should have. So yeah. And it is really tough. It is tough to be in those dwells, right? And I don't think Alisson has had many of them. I don't think there's many teams that have come up against him and done that to him. So he's not going to be ready for it. When you played against Stoke and when you played against Bolton, you knew exactly what you're in for. You actually prepared for it leading up to it. Not that it made it, not that you were able to deal with it necessarily, but you just knew what you were going to face, right? So there was a level of expectation of what was going to happen to you. But I don't think Alisson was expecting that sort of physical contact in that box. But again, I think it wasn't a foul either.
Claude, my job is done. Three seasons of the Gagan pod, and I've got two goalkeepers agree that there wasn't a foul on the goalkeeper. Mic drop. See us later. Thanks for the time.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Mate, where are you going? I gotta ask you something before you go, Bridgie, mate. I got to ask you something about this West Ham side. They're now equal second, 3 points behind Chelsea. You can smell potentially a fairy tale, but I think any sort of European football will be a great result for them. They're looking good. But a few of their players were left out of this England squad, and there were question marks raised talking about this big club bias. People like Jared Bowen were left out, and you saw Fikayo Tomori, who's been so good for AC Milan, left out of the squad. Tyrone Mings is in. Greenwood's out. What's going on? What have you made of Gareth Southgate's squad selection now as we move into the international break coming up this weekend?
I'm not going to say anything bad against Southgate because he's doing a fantastic job, and he's got a lot of players to pick from, and that is such a luxury to have, and that is a novelty. We only discussed in the right back position. It's, you know, competition for players is great. However, when I see the likes of Mings getting in, and I agree that when you're not performing, that is a bit of a dodgy one. And the boy, Bowen, he's in my fantasy league team every week. He picks up points. What I like about Bowen, his work ethic with and without the ball. He's a super player, and he just gets better every season and every game that he plays, and he's having an impact in. That was a big stand-up for me. I was surprised that he didn't give a chance because, you know, Bamford got an opportunity as well when he was doing well for Leeds United. He came in as a bit of a wild card, and I thought Bowen justified a position in there. And he would have been the one I would have put in there, definitely.
Yeah, but Bridget, that assist at the weekend, he holds up four players, you know, at full speed, and then he slips it through to Fornals. I think that, you know, just in that showed his quality of his speed.
The confidence and that he is playing with Tommy at this moment in time, that's huge. And when you're playing with that kind of confidence to get him inside the England setup, I thought it would have been nice and rewarding and justified.
I think what Gareth does, and has been doing it pretty much the whole time he's been there, once he's found his squad of players and they're doing okay for their teams, he still kind of sticks with them because they've done it for him at international level. I think one of the best examples is Jordan Pickford. So domestically with his club, he wasn't playing well and had like 12 months, 18 months where he struggled. But he was continuously picked again for England. And when he played for England, he played well and has never let England down. So I think Gareth, in a lot of ways, makes those selection decisions based on the same theory. That's why Tyrone Mings is in there, because during the Euros, he didn't let England down. He didn't let Gareth down. And I think that's arguably at times more important, that you've got players, you know their personalities, you know what they can do and can't do, and you feel like you can rely on them any moment. And they kind of know their position in the squad. But I agree with you, Jarrod Bowen is certainly unlucky. But I think if he plays well between now and the next sort of round, then I think there's internationals. I think he's got a good chance of getting. Because if you think about it, I don't know, last season Jarrod Bowen played well, but he certainly hadn't been at the same level as he's playing this season, I don't think. Is that right? Is that fair to say?
Definitely. And I think he's grown with the team. I think you see a lot of players in that West Ham side who's come from, smaller settings, and now with West Ham moving up, their level has come up as well. So,
because there's a certain level of, I mean, certainly I believe anyway with the national team, there's got to be a certain level of, just because you play well for say 5 months, does that mean necessarily you should be selected for your national team and play on the national team? I think there's a certain period of you need to earn the right and deliver at a level for a certain amount of time before that even is discussed about. I just think too easily, too quickly, people get... I mean, look, you look at Patrick Bamford, like you mentioned, he had a great season last season in terms of goal return, right? And it took him almost over a year to get in an England side or get a game or even get called up for the national team. So I think that's pretty much... I think what Gareth has done is pretty consistent. Whether you think it's the right thing or not is another thing, but I think he's been consistent in the way he selects his players.
Yeah, but also what we have to remember with national team, because you only have X amount of training sessions, continuity is so important.
Yep.
If you swap all the time, you know, going into, they've got maybe three training sessions leading up to games. So if you got to then implement two or three, four or five new players every time, it's just not possible. So I quite like that, you know, the managers stick to a sort of at least a core of players, and then you can always draft in one or two for every game.
Well, another manager who's sticking to his core group, your boys, Tommy. Denmark, they're in action again on Optus Sport this weekend, and their qualifying campaign is just remarkable. I don't remember ever seeing anything like this. They've got to be on track for some sort of record. 8 games, 8 wins. They've scored 27 goals and they haven't conceded yet. They've still got to play.
Anybody can do it. The Faroe Islands can do it.
Well, that's what I was going to say. They've still got to play Faroe Islands and Scotland.
Richard, I was just going to go opposite and say they've definitely got to continue that against the Faroe Islands. But yeah, as you said, they'll probably score. And
they've got the Faroe Islands and Scotland. So this could get downright ugly. But this Danish squad, it looks like a great unit. I was watching the Serie A on the week on Simon Kjær. Seems like he's really going into that upper echelon of centre-backs in world football. Are they starting to dream of something special at the World Cup next year?
I think they should. You know, they should be optimistic for sure. You know, if they can keep you know, people fit. I think Damsko is injured at the moment. He's had an operation, a small one. So, but other than that, you know, they just got, again, continuity. They got this the same spine of players. Obviously, Schmeichel has been great for them, as you said, Simon Kjær, Christensen, who I think is one of the, you know, best underrated center halves in the world and in the Premier League as well. And then you look at Højbjerg up all the way up to, they probably lack a striker, I would say. That's the only downside. They lack
Yusuf Poulsen. How can you say that? What a legend, Yusuf Poulsen.
You know,
he's a Leipzig, he's an RB Leipzig legend, mate. I tell you what,
okay,
I'm a big fan. I love his work rate. I think he's so versatile. I think I like him.
And that's what Denmark has. You know, they have versatility. You know, they have three or four you know, Jensen at Brentford. You know, so they've got players that they can pop in. But I just, you know, in those big games, if you play France at the World Cup, or you need some player that sort of, you know, has that X factor. You know, we used to have Niklas Bendtner, love him or hate him, but he used to come up with a crucial goal, Jondal Thomason in the past. And I think this team, great collective, a great high quality of players, but I think they're just lacking that killer striker when we get to quarterfinals, semifinals, at a big tournament. So, but that, you know, Denmark, and this is what we're talking about. This is what I'm talking about now. I can't really believe that, you know, we're you know, how far Juhlmann has taken his team. So it's just fantastic. So we're enjoying it in Denmark.
Well, I love Kasper Dahlberg, but he's been struggling a little bit for game time at Nice.
Yeah, and he's had a lot of injuries as well. He just seems to, you know, like at the Euros, pops up and then he gets injured and it's in and out. So sadly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Denmark in action, England in action, that's all on Optus Sport. With Schwartzy, you've played a couple of games from Australia in your time. And I want to talk about the Socceroos, who are back in action, finally back on home soil as well after 2 years. And before we dive into the squad and all that, there's a lot of optimism around our home record. And I wanted to ask you, why is our home record so well? You've experienced playing around Asia, around all around Oceania, World Cups, everything. How come when we step on home soil, teams struggle to come here? Is it the fact that it's the long travel, or do our boys just step up when they're in front of their families and all the rest?
There's a combination of things, I think. Most teams, you know, like you think about it, most teams have got decent home records, right? I think for a lot of the teams in Asia, it's a climate change. For, believe it or not, for a lot of them, it's really cold being in Australia. Mm. We talk about going to places in Asia and trying to play football where it's so, so hot, humid. The conditions of football pitches are really tough to play in. Even to a degree, when I was playing for the Socceroos, we certainly played on a lot of pitches, even on home soil, that were not international level because they played a rugby league match or a rugby union match or something, or a cricket game or whatever the day before. And that happened so many times, and it made our job certainly a little bit more difficult. But yeah, so I think it's a combination of intimidation as well, because Australia is one of the big dogs in Asia, right? So everyone sees it as a real challenge, a major scalp if they can get a result against Australia, and they kind of tend to come a little bit more defensive. I don't know. I think it's more about the fact that the travel as well. They struggle with that bit of extra travel.
Tommy, looking at this Australian squad after they've lost to Japan most recently, they've got them hot on their heels. Something tells me Japan won't lose too many more games from here on out. How crucial is this game at home to Saudi Arabia and then the following match against China for our boys?
Oh, massive. I was just sad that, you know, Aaron Moy can't be there. You know, he's a massive miss. You know, I played with him at Melbourne City, and what he's done since, the creativity, set plays. But again, I think they're in a good spot. And as Mark said, you know, that the travel, you need to take advantage. There'll be a great crowd in Sydney. And, you know, you need to win these games, you know, to qualify. And I'm sure they'll be confident. I think they've looked solid. Suter at the back and set plays as well. So you always got that in a bag. You know, if it's the tight game, you know, you can, you know, you can rely on a little bit like West Ham. You can rely on that physicality in those situations. And I don't expect Saudi Arabia to be able to deal with it. You know, that they'll be trying to play, you know, technical and a little bit like that Arabian style of football. So I think you can put some physicality in there and get on top of them.
Bridgie, you saw the Socceroos lose to Japan in the most recent game. And I think some question marks maybe were raised on the way we went to Japan and set up. And I thought the Japanese played very well and they dominated proceedings when it came to a possession standpoint, as they so often do. Should we be worried at the moment with the current style of play or results of Australia, or are you feeling pretty confident as well for your adopted nation to make their fifth straight World Cup?
No, very confident. And when you've got a run like that and a record that they've been on, it just spreads confidence amongst the players. And, you know, the Japan game, you've just said it there, technically, yes, very, very much, an established nation. The manager was having a few issues there. He was under pressure and they just seemed to turn it on that night against Australia in the Socceroos. But I've got to say, I thought it was a very, very even battle. Do you know, when you look at the stats and things, Australia weren't outplayed. They weren't outdone. We dominated the possession. We had equal amount of shots as well. It's just that they were more clinical on the night. And at some point, Japan, the pressure was on the manager. The players went out there and performed. I think it's going to be a tough game against Saudi Arabia. I understand what Tommy was saying there. But it's going to be interesting to see the bounce back ability, that word that was invented by, I think it was Ian Holloway, to see how they're going to bounce back and get back to that winning way and do it. And I think the home advantage is huge. Tommy's just mentioned there with the crowds being back, everybody wanting to get behind the sport. So it was, I think the boys will a lift from that. And Arnie will have them switched on and ready to go, because you can't just say one result against a nation that is a very, very powerful nation in Japan. They've had a slip up early on, but this will kickstart their qualification, no doubt about it. So we've got a little kicker on them, and going into the Saudi game, I'm going to say Socceroos 2-1 will get the victory.
Let's hope so. I mean, it feels like a must-win game when you still got to play top of the group, home and away.
The physicality that he was talking about there as well with Suter and Trent Sainsbury from set players, I think that's going to be invaluable.
Mm. Well, Schwartzy, Johnny Stensness, who played for New Zealand at a youth level, has been called up into the Socceroos now. He's hopefully maybe potentially handed his first cap, but is there anyone you think missed out on this squad or anyone that Arnie's got to be looking at in the next few months? It's tricky with the A-League at the moment. He's still called up a few A-League players, I think just purely because he has to. He doesn't have anyone else to pick from. But who else should he be looking at in the months to come?
Well, I know you'll definitely be looking at a player that he had at the Olympics. I actually caught up with him last week, who is absolutely on fire for Hearts, Cam Devlin. And he's done incredibly well. There wasn't a person. I mean, whenever he mentioned his name, people come over to him and said to me, "You know, what are you doing up here in Scotland? What are you doing in Edinburgh?" I'm going, I'm catching up with one of your players. And they were just like, "Oh, what a player. You know, how incredible has he been? Now, you know, his work rate, his fighting spirit, the way he's transformed the midfield." I've got no doubt he'll be. He certainly is on the radar, and he won't be far off if he continues doing what he's doing and playing as well as he has for Hearts.
And Tommy, Johnny has been called up to the squad after leaving Australia and going overseas. He's playing in Norway. And I actually did speak to Arnie as well last week, and it was interesting about how the current situation with the current situation with the A-League means he can't really pick new players because they're just not playing regular football week in, week out. It's been pushed out again this season. So do Australian players have to leave Australia and go play in leagues that aren't necessarily the top in Europe, but just to give themselves the best chance to make the Socceroos team? Do they have to leave?
I think it depends under what terms. I still think that the A-League is a good spot. I think the problem is, you know, now the season has moved. Hopefully in years to come, you know, when it starts to expand, you know, you're looking at Leckie, Jamie McLaren, who's come back. So for some players, they adapt quickly and they become successful. John Rowe, did well there, and has sort of created a bit of a career. So it sort of swings and roundabouts. So it's a tough decision because it's a different environment. Like it's very protected in the A-League. And you know you're going to play games. If you go abroad, you got to get your elbows out and be ready to fight because there'll be plenty who wants to take your position. Mm. If you want a big future in football, you can't stay in Australia forever. I encourage people, if they have the right credentials, you know, that they should really go and try it.
Schwartzy and Claude, Schwartzy was on this new documentary. What's the new doco about the ex-players?
Striking Gold, the Premier League one?
Yes, Striking Gold. I was watching that on the Optus Sport app yesterday, and, you know, 25 minutes to give me a little understanding of the, obviously playing with Harry Kewell and Mark Viduka, I knew the quality in the history, but there was some good stuff to come out of that about the future and the development of where we go in Australia and how the A-League was meant to, you know, catapult players getting more games on home soil, but because of the competition being so small and a little bit diluted, and it's taken longer to get back to what the old NSL used to be like, where players would come through at a high quality and be able to go overseas. It was just showing the stumbling blocks of where players are going. There's more money available in Asia. I thought it was a very, very good insight for somebody that didn't really understand what the NSL was all about and how many games and how these clubs were culture. You live there, you've lived and breathed it, a bit like what I'm used to back home. I think the A-League clubs are still, you know, have been developing. It doesn't just happen overnight. And I'm hoping with the expansion and the leagues trying to align with more European football going through the summer period will help the development, because it was really sad to see nobody on the team sheet from Australia in the Premier League last weekend.
Yeah, it is a concern. We've talked about lots over the years, and I said it many, many years ago that the A-League, as good as it's been domestically, it's great for football in Australia, but it also can hinder some of the players going forward and going overseas. Players that probably, you know, the old NSL, the A-League is wonderful because players are able to become professional, earn a decent amount of money and still be in Australia. Yeah. So some players will possibly have less desire to leave and really push the boat out there and really try and get themselves to another level. Then you add the fact, add the mix that we joined Asia in 2007. And obviously the avenues that open up for going to Asia are enormous, right? So we know that there are various areas around Asia where you can earn lots and lots of money, and players who have maybe no European passport or certainly feel that, okay, there's too much money that I can't turn down for, you know, for the sake of 1 year, 2 years or whatever it is to go to Asia. Whereas in the years gone by, certainly when I was growing up, the opportunities to go to Asia were so few and far between. Yes, there were some players that went to Japan, but not many because they didn't have a lot of foreigners.
Schwartzy, what you've got to take on board now is the Brexit situation. Under-18s can't just go into Europe can't go into England like Harry Kewell was able to at a younger age. You've got to go via Europe and another avenue rather than
That's just one avenue that's obviously been hindered, right? And the Premier League is the Premier League, right? And obviously there's a natural attraction for Aussies to go there. But you have to be at a certain level to be able to play at that level, to get into the Premier League. You know, one thing is to be there and be involved in a squad and everything else, but if you've got no chance of playing, that's difficult, right? So what I've also really liked is the fact that we've got a lot of Australian players and have, even over the last couple of years particularly, a lot of Aussies going to Scotland. And the great thing about it is the vast majority of them are playing, you know, and having opportunities to play. So maybe that's our New England for now, until they potentially make that next step up again.
And that's what the national coach, Graham Arnold, still is going on about in this country. We do not play enough games. So I think he'll be delighted that the players that are going over to Scotland are playing that amount of games now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The intensity, the atmosphere of playing in a country that's football mad, the fans, the stadiums that are only for football. Teams, the football teams only play there. No one else plays there. You know, that's all the issues that we'll always have in Australia until such time as teams have their own stadiums and don't let anyone else play on them. But that's another thing altogether. I just think not playing enough games, having 3 months of preseason, it is what it is. And they've done incredibly well. And hopefully over time, sooner rather than later, and obviously now with the A-League being by itself and setting everything up and hopefully it can develop even further. There'll be more teams involved, more games, and hopefully the quality will get better, even more so. And it will create even more avenues and opportunities for young players coming through to then go on to bigger and better things. And hopefully they all want to play in the best leagues in the world. And that's Europe.
There was a really interesting point that Arnie brought up about us going back to Oceania. That's his opinion, that would be a good move, which I thought was very interesting. But
I don't agree with that. I actually don't agree with that at all.
His reasoning, right? I can't say I agree with it either, but his reasoning for it was that when he took charge of the Olyroos, and now with the Socceroos
qualify.
Exactly right. He's saying World Cups and all these players stuff, have no experience. They get to Socceroos level. They've never played three games in a week. They've never played South American opposition. They've never felt World Cup football. Whereas once upon a time, you guys at least played 17s, 20s, Olyroos. By the time you got to Socceroos, you were ready for that. Do you think that's valid? Does that sound like we're just throwing in the towel and saying Asia's too hard?
It's very different. It's very, well, Asia's not too hard. When I say it's not too hard, it is very hard, right? But it hasn't been too hard. We've qualified every time.
At senior
level. When we're in Oceania, we didn't. We only qualified twice. And the last time was 2005, for the 2006 World Cup. So I think it would be a massive step backwards. Yes, our younger teams would have experiences of playing in international football. But I tell you now, me playing an under-16s World Cup back in 1989 did not get me ready for playing a World Cup qualifier for the Socceroos, right?
Okay.
I didn't play at the under-20s World Cup. I was injured and then I had to withdraw from the squad.
There was better goalkeepers.
And there were better goalkeepers as well because Bozza was the number one. So I don't think, yes, it gives you an experience, but it doesn't prepare you for playing for the full national team, playing for the Socceroos. No, in World Cup qualifiers, absolutely not. What does is playing at the highest level, leaving Australia, mm-hmm. playing in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Because Australia will never be the number one league in the world for football, right? No. Let's be honest. Certainly none of our lifetime. That's a given for me. But it certainly can improve and get better and better and better. So, but hopefully we still have a lot of players coming through and dreaming about playing at the highest level and not necessarily be just taking second best and chasing the short term. And it's hard because you know, a lot of money up for grabs. I get it. I totally understand it. I suppose for me, it was easy because it was another option. Hmm. So, one of the problems, if you want to call it a problem, is that players have options now. And sometimes that can be detrimental to someone's development because they may make the wrong decision if they've got too many options.
Well, I just feel, Tommy, you experienced the A-League most recently, and I just feel like what really has to happen, in my opinion, is that maybe the days have changed. I know Bridgie and I have spoken about this in the office, that times are different now for whatever reason. Maybe it's more players available. Maybe it's the different visa scenarios in Europe, but there is more to pick from for European clubs. And I'm of the belief that Australians need to try and play in the A-League at first grade level and be sold to European opposition rather than going with a backpack on and asking for a trial. Tommy, do you think that's got to be the way forward?
You know, I think the level in Europe on a broader base is a lot higher than it was. And I actually think that development-wise, Australia has taken a step back compared to a lot of nations. You're looking at a time when Swartzy came through and Bridget were talking about, you know, the club culture and how players were brought through to now the pathways is a lot more muddy. We're seeing the academies now with Melbourne City, Western Sydney. It's slowly starting to get some traction, but there's still a lot of grassroots development that sort of just gets lost because there's no structure, not enough pitches, like Swartzy said, having to compete with other sports, not playing for 6 months of the year. So I think actually, you know, for Australia to get back on track, I think you need to get all that in place, and that's going to take time. But the Socceroos is a driving force because that's what makes young kids want to play football. You look up to your heroes, and like the Matildas, we've seen what effect they have on young girls, and that's what needs to happen. I think for the men's as well.
Do you know what I would like to see happen as well? Which I think was a huge thing in my development as a kid. We used to play
Tottenham win the Premier League.
I won't see it in my lifetime. Won't see it in my lifetime. It's youth tournaments and pre-season tournaments, youth tournaments. I used to love the development of me playing against other clubs from around Europe in youth tournaments. I would love to see the A-League clubs actually embrace an opportunity to go and showcase their talent from their academies. Instead of a kid putting on a backpack, it's a way that the clubs can go, you know what it is, let's go and see if we can participate in a tournament where we know there's going to be some quality there. And the only club that I've seen do it when I went to Hong Kong initially was Wellington Phoenix. They went and showcased and they're playing against Atletico Madrid, Newcastle United, Leicester, was in the Hong Kong Soccer Sevens. Go and try and compete or get some matches against teams in Europe. You're showcasing yourselves, you're giving the experience to the players, and what you are doing, you're also putting every player on notice to the other clubs to see if there's any players that stand out. We'll keep an eye on them. You can have them in the future. That's how you develop relationships with other clubs, and it gives players and clubs opportunities. I would love to see the A-League clubs do that and spend a bit of money to go and take part in pre-season tournaments around the world.
But I don't think A-League clubs necessarily are that. There are some, certainly, but that's not their number one priority.
But the development of the education their players will help that as well, and the coaches can chat with the coaches.
There's no incentive for them. That's the problem. There's no incentive for them. The players are on short-term contracts.
Well, there is to sell the players.
But they're not on contracts long enough.
Exactly.
What, the youth team players? I'm on about academy kids and that.
The whole ethos, the whole setup and the mentality is that they're all on short-term contracts.
I'm not talking about the A-League first team. I'm talking about their youth teams.
But even that, you can't sell them. What are you going to sell them for? That's the problem.
Yeah, you can't. They have to be on a pro contract before you can sell them anyway.
Yeah. And even once they get to that level, we don't get those 5-year contracts that they get in Europe.
That's right. And that's what I'm saying. So the short term, it's always a short term for a lot of the A-League clubs is to like, okay, how competitive can we be in the A-League? That's our number one priority. And I think for a lot of A-League clubs, correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is a lot of them are not that interested in playing the Asian Champions League either. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's what they say.
Yeah. And I can vouch for that.
But I don't understand that. You know, you're trying to be at the highest level, play at the highest level and have success. I don't understand that. Mm. But anyway, it is what it is. But I think if clubs continue to have that short-term outlook, you'll have so many players that will go through the cracks. So many players will still put that backpack on and leave because they don't see a pathway. I think unless you break into the A-League as a young player, that's your pathway. Break in, sign for a year or two, play well for that year or two, and then leave on a free and join a club in Europe or in Asia. That's the mentality for a lot of players. So clubs, you know, it's all about, well, we don't make money out of them because they leave for free anyway, or they wait for their contract to go down. But it's because they don't give them long enough contracts. You give a young player a 4 or 5 year contract and then sell him. You've got a possibility to do that, but they don't. They don't take that risk on.
Yeah, yeah. At least playing in the A-League, they get proper broadcast. You can see the players. You know, the clubs from Europe can actually see that it's a professional level of football. Gone are the days of your dad videotaping you from the grandstand. Well,
exactly.
You know?
And a lot of players have come out of the A-League and gone and played in Europe and played in different parts of Asia. So it is very much a place where people, clubs and foreign clubs will come in and go, right, we're looking in the A-League because there are players there who are decent enough, good enough to play at our level. And we can generally get them for next to nothing.
Yeah. I'll leave you guys with a funny story because I'm going to lighten the mood. Actually, when I was playing, Schwartzy, there was a Marconi boy. I think Marconi Olympic. And his dad used to film him.
Hey, don't confuse that. Don't confuse that, right? It's like Marconi Olympic. Get that right, mate.
I can't remember where we were at the time, but there was a dad that used to film his son, send him to clubs overseas. And he put together this whole montage tape of his son playing. True story. I won't say the name. Sent it to a few clubs in the Premier League. And one of them was Blackburn Rovers. And they got back to him and they actually asked him about another player in the videotape. And they ended up signing him.
I've heard that before, actually. I've heard that story before.
Yeah. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. But guys, look, I mean, we can be all doom and gloom about the A-League as much as we want, but we do come to life when the Socceroos are in action. When the Socceroos are playing, we're excited. I have a feeling that when we chat next Tuesday, we're going to have Socceroos, England, and Denmark all winning.
Hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully.
Fingers crossed.
Very realistic. Yeah.
I mean, listen, and then, the bottom line is as long as Australia win, that's the main thing, right?
It's true. It's very true.
Yeah, because England have already qualified.
Yeah.
It's easy. European qualification is a bit of a joke. Let's be real.
You know, as much as we qualify, if we lose to Faroe Islands at home, I think we're...
Well, your tough one comes after that against
the manager.
Yeah,
he can go to Villa.
Oh, brilliant, guys.
Close, before we go, quick one here.
Yeah,
I chucked in last night. I was doing PLP feedback and they were asking me about the next Aston Villa manager. I chucked in Ange Postecoglou. There you go. I give him a massive rap and I said, get him in. If Stevie Gerrard's good enough, get Ange in. Because I thought it was amazing to see the Celtic fans have embraced him and they've seen what he's all about. And they got his name in a Christmas song. That was amazing. How you can get Postecoglou into a song, it just shows you, man. He's won them over. So it's, what do you think of that?
Yeah, you know what? I heard them sing that song, exact same song, but for Brendan Rodgers before. So,
it's just getting recycled, is it?
Just recycled.
It's not a good omen. Right. Not a good omen.
he'll take it, though. He'll take it. No, it's good to see him doing well over there. He's won the fans over. Guys, I'm going to leave it there for today on the Gagan Pod. It's been an awesome chat. We've covered everything club football, international football, and on Optus Sport this week, we have international games from Friday all the way through to next Wednesday. So make sure you check that out. Big thank you to Mark Schwarzer, Thomas Sorensen, and Michael Bridges. As always, gentlemen, I'll see you next week. And guys, you can check out all the rest on the app. If you haven't had enough of these lovely faces and voices, check out all the rest on the app. Highlights, player cams, anything you could ever want. And we'll see you next week on the Gagan Pod.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.